Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Well, if you're a native Tulsan, you've undoubtedly seen her work around our city. Today, we're going to meet Tulsa-based sculptor Rosalyn Cook. She's a nationally recognized artist whose life-size or larger sculptures grace parks, hospitals, libraries, corporate headquarters, and churches around the country. Over 30 sculptures can be seen here in Tulsa alone, from Utica Square, Harwelden, and the Tulsa Garden Center, to Southern Hills, Mohawk, and Woodward Parks, to River Parks, to the Helmrich and Kaiser Libraries. Altogether, over 92 sculptures and monuments are on display around the United States and Canada. Her work is filled with a sense of beauty, love, and joy, whether it's a wistful young golfer thinking about the future, a boy discovering a frog, a minstrel dancing to his flute, a child discovering a love of reading or a religious subject. Rosalyn Cook's work display that universal desire to enjoy life to the fullest, which is probably why her works are so popular. Her work has been shown at galleries and exhibitions around the country and has been honored in many ways. In fact, that she'll be inducted into the Tulsa Hall of Fame in early October. And now she prepares to retire and step away from life-size sculpture. She's put together a beautiful book about her work titled Capturing the Spirit in Bronze, The Journey and Sculptures of Rosalyn Cook. She has a number of signings planned in the next few weeks, two this weekend, Saturday at the Tulsa Historical Society at 1 o'clock, and Sunday at Philbrook Museum of Art at 2 o'clock. Rosalyn Cook is my guest today. Rosalyn Cook, it's a pleasure to have you on Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
It's great for me to be here. Thank
you. And I've enjoyed your work all over the city, as many Tulsans have. And this book tells us that whole story of how you became a sculptor and how the commissions came about and the stories behind most, or if not all, of the sculptures we see here in Tulsa and as we travel around the country. What was the reason for the book?
Really, three reasons. I wanted to inspire people who have a dream. How many people say, someday I'm going to learn to speak Italian or write a cookbook? And I had a dream too, and I just followed it, and I had to get equipped to do it. And so I hope this inspires people to say, now's the time, and I'm going to do it. The second reason, I wanted to document the pieces that I have in Tulsa and around the world, and some of the amazing people involved with it, the wonderful, wonderful Tulsa people. And some of the amazing things that happened in the studio during the creation of the pieces. And then third reason is just my thank you to Tulsa, because Tulsa is a great place to live and raise your family and work. And, you know, no man is an island. We all had help from other people and friendships and support and cheerleaders and people who believed in you when you can't believe in yourself. And that's all in a big thank you in this book.
And really, this is a culmination because you're formally retiring from the large-scale sculptures.
Yes, from creating new pieces, really. I may create some small pieces, but no more of the monumental size.
An artist should never say never, though.
Well, you know, I'm looking at a new season in my life. I would say it's taken me 3 years to contemplate the possibility of it, to get to where I know that it's the right time and the right thing for me to do right now. And there were a lot of things, factors that came into that. We have a home in Colorado that we go to in the summer. Our children have moved to Colorado. Our grandchildren are in Colorado. And I'm getting the little A word, you know, the arthritis in my hands and back. And
Is it more difficult to work?
Oh, yes. My thumbs really hurt if I try and work. And some days are good and some days are bad. So, but I just feel God's timing has been perfect in my life for what I've done, and now it's a new season.
Now, the book tells the story of your life. You were born in Peru. I did not know that.
I was.
And has that been a connection to you most of your life? Or
My parents are American parents. My dad was a rancher, American rancher down there. And I think it gave me maybe my roots for creativity, because we lived high up in the Andes in a little village, and there were no stores, no toys. We had to create everything out of string and tin cans and carved ivory soap and made our own kites, you know, a lot of that.
Did you carve ivory soap when you
I did. Did you?
No, I
did. A lot of people did. I know. My dad did, too, when he was a kid. But also, it gave me such a love for indigenous people of different countries. And actually, that's been reflected in my work, because for the Monuments for World Vision and Compassion, and there are all kinds of different anatomy characteristics for different races. And I've just loved capturing the humanness of each of these indigenous people.
Yeah. You loved art growing up, but came time to go to college. Your father said, no, you got to major in something practical.
Yes. I don't think he wanted me to come home and live anymore at home. He likes me, though. I mean, we loved each other.
So you got a degree in special ed.
I did.
And worked at that for a while. But after you got married and were living in Dallas, mm-hmm. you happened upon a person named Octavio Medellin.
Medellin. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
He was a man from Mexico, and he had a studio, an art studio, and actually a pouring foundry over in Oak Cliff. And I was pregnant with my first child, bored to death because I had decided to quit teaching to be a stay-at-home mom. So I took that sculpting class, and I call it the aha of my life. It was like I discovered something I was meant to be doing, because moving clay into meaningful forms was so fulfilling. I mean, like way over the top of anything I'd experienced in painting.
You know, you mentioned doing the ivory soap sculptures.
Oh, yeah.
Was that, do you think that had some?
Oh, I never even connected that, because when I work in clay, so it's
sure.
additive.
Yeah.
It's very forgiving. If you make a mistake, you just pull the clay off, redo it.
Got to get another bar of soap when you make a mistake.
You know, when you're working in marble or granite or soap, yeah, it's not so easy. I never connected those two.
But the idea of molding the clay that appealed to you.
Oh, yes. And actually, I think in three dimensions. My drawings, actually, I draw in clay anymore. If I'm working on a concept for a piece, I'll just use a lot of soft clay, like Gumby figures, remember them,
mm-hmm.
and work out my design and composition in a clay, because I can see the undercuts and I can see how it would, as I turn it, I can see the different directions. Much more, it matched who I am better than painting.
And out of that experience, you got the sculpting bug, I guess.
Oh, I did. And Octavio helped me. And there, I worked with another man named Claude Hickson, who was a metallurgist. And he actually showed me how to work in a medium called, because I'd worked in terracotta clay for years. I did people's children and dogs and, you know, bought a used kiln and fired them. But when you move into plastiline, it has to have a mold and be cast in something else. And it's... there's no end to what you can do in a plastiline with an armature. And so I learned that. Then I took a class with Glenna Goodacre. Are you familiar with her?
No.
She's probably the most prominent woman sculptor of the century, but she has had a stroke and has stopped. But I took a class from her, and at the end of the class, a week-long class in Scottsdale, she pulled me over and she said, you know, Rosalind, you have a gift. You might want to think about this as more than a hobby. And I went, me? Really? So it melded with my passion. So I started just crossing off days each week instead of doing Cub Scouts and all the things mothers do. My kids were older by then anyway. So I started crossing off days of the week to work and study and create. And of course, I'd get calls saying, can you do this? Can you do that? And I'd say, oh, I'm sorry, I've got a commitment. And it was to me,
yeah.
you know.
And it's really self-educated in sculpture.
Well, I had great teachers.
But you pursued it yourself.
I had lots of empty holes, though, Rich. You know, like anatomy. I did take 2 years of anatomy where I actually would make muscles out of clay and attach them to a skeleton. So I'm learning, but using all of my senses. And it really translated into my work beautifully, and it made a huge difference.
Now, I have no idea how they teach that in an art school. Is that how they teach it in an art school, or is that just your own technique?
A lot of it. I had actually an anatomy book from medical school, and I actually had a massage therapist who has to know all their muscles, insertion, origin, functions of every muscle, would come to my house. I paid her on a weekly basis, and it took us 2 years to get through the body. Of course, I did have tests on that. I mean, it was very serious stuff.
Right.
But it reflected in my work. It was good.
So you'd been doing these terracotta sculptures for friends and neighbors. At what point did you say, okay, I'm not going to do this as a hobby. I'm going to be an artist.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's sort of a gradual realization at the time. But But at what point did you say, you know, I think
it's when Glenna Goodacre believed in me and I began to pursue it. And I remember creating this piece called Adoration, which is in my book. It's my first piece. I look at it now and it makes my toes curl. But, you know,
curls in a good way or a bad way?
Well, I hopefully have come a lot further than that. But I actually entered that in a show. Be Okay had a show in 1989 called Of Women by Women. And it was a step of faith for me. I thought, I think I'm going to enter this. And I entered one other piece. I sold them both that night. I'll never forget the joy that I had that somebody would actually pay money for something of mine. I remember calling my parents with great excitement. And it was amazing that a few days later, a man named Joe Dodson, Dodson Gallery in Nichols Hills in Oklahoma City, said, Rosalind, you know, I see great potential in you, and I'd like to rep you as you begin your career. And I was going, wow. I mean, really, it's the goodness of other people who believed in me when I couldn't believe in myself. And then I went to Italy and studied the master's works, which also had a huge impact on my sculptures.
In what way?
Design and composition, flowing fabric, flowing hair, how to create S-curves for females, angles for males, multi-figured sculptures, generally a neat isosceles or any kind of a triangle is a strong composition. Creating emotion, passion, anxiety, loss, suffering, all those things are through the Renaissance works. And that's capturing the spirit. I never wanted to just reproduce a cute kid or a cute Madonna or so. You see, I wanted people to look at my work and know what that person was thinking or was feeling. And I think people can connect that way.
And I think that's one of the nice things your book does, is it sort of gives you the insights of the little things that you're hoping people will see. Maybe they have seen it, maybe they haven't. That's a part of the sculptures. And I know the one my eye is always drawn to is the minstrel in front of the Arts and Humanities Council. And that came a little later, but that just captures the joy of the arts.
That was probably my most difficult piece as far as balancing.
Right, you because know, it's just a very small
support. He's only balanced this 11-foot piece on the ball of his foot. And actually, then you marry with the foundry. And they said you have to have a stainless steel rod that goes up inside of the sculpture from his chest 8 feet into the ground so that if, like, the football team decides they're going to have a night on the town and pull it down, they can't. You have to think about those things.
Well, I wanted to ask you about that decision to go to large-scale pieces because it's one thing, and it's a whole nother ballgame to be talking life-size or larger because it's a big investment of your own money. And how did that come about?
The very first commission, I could never afford to create, say, 8-foot pieces with my own bank account. You know, those needed to be commissioned, and that means they're safe. World Vision, which is the largest Christian relief and development agency, contacted me in 1994, and they had seen a portfolio of my work. But I'd never done anything larger than 3 or 4 feet. And they wanted me to create a monument that reflected their mission statement for their new headquarters in Washington. And as you read in my book, I was going to say, are they crazy? They think I'm someone different. They don't know. I have no idea how to do this. But I just knew in my heart that God is going to show me. It would not have come to me. And I wanted to do it. So again, I had to learn, using a maquette, how to size it up. I took measurements, dropped plumb lines. That's why I put that, the first really story in my book, because that's where I learned to capture the spirit in bronze. And actually, I discovered I love working big as opposed to minuscule little faces or tiny. I love working big.
You know, earlier you said you just don't want to have a charming little child as a sculpture, but I tell you that's one of the great appeals of your work is the children that you depict. They have that wonderful innocence, and there's something somewhat inspiring about the facial features.
And I have nothing against children. I just don't want to do like a cute figure of any kind because I don't think that The reason you like a piece, if you really think about it, is the movement, the flow, the expression, the joy or the pensiveness or the whatever you're seeing in their face. And that doesn't come about with a preconceived idea. It comes about with a lot of work. And you build in all the things that support that piece to be a good piece of sculpture.
And in that particular case, it is Christ looking upon these children, and they're children from a variety of cultures. And it looks like you did a lot of work in learning at the ethnographic nature of each child. It's a beautiful piece. And I'm not sure if it was that one or another sculpture of Jesus that you said, I don't know if this is right. And you had a gentleman come to your...
Tell us that story.
My
goodness. I had only 5 months to create five monumental-sized pieces for World Vision. And, you know, the Oklahoma City bombing was going on during the time I was doing the children, which was really forcing me to put life into these children and joy into these children. But the face of Christ, I just couldn't get it. And I had taken the head off of the body and put it on a pedestal so I could work it life-size. And there's scaffolding around it. The big piece. And so he looked like Santa Claus, or he'd look like, I just couldn't get it. And finally, my deadlines were coming up, and of course, with great prayer, and I just felt I had to work on this face. And so I began to think about Christ's character qualities. And I thought, if I can get his character qualities in the face, then I'll get the face. So I worked and worked, and I finally got a face. It was about 1 a.m. and I fell into bed in exhaustion, and I just said to the Lord, Father, I think this is a good face, but I need to know that you like this face, that you approve of it, and never thought anything more about it. The next morning, I'm up on scaffolding, putting the head onto the whole body, and the telephone rang, and no, it wasn't God, but it was a doctor who is one of my clients, and he said, Rosalind, he said, I'm in town on a medical convention. I'd like to bring some doctors over to your studio, and I'm working on a tight deadline. So everything within me wanted to say, oh, I'm sorry, this is not possible. But of course I said, sure, come on over, but I'm going to keep working. So I'm working, and these 8 doctors are in my studio milling around, and my studio is huge. I have a gallery area, a work area, lots of projects are always going on, in a library area. But there was this one doctor that kept looking at the face of Christ as I was fixing the muscles of the neck. And so I just put my tools down and I said, can I answer any questions for you? And he says to me these exact words, I'll never forget it. He said, you know, all I've ever seen is the suffering, emaciated Christ. He said, I just couldn't relate. But, you know, I think I could go fishing with this guy. And I thought, oh, that's it. Because I knew I'd captured a face that was wooing, that was friendly, that was not stern, that was not judgmental. This man, to this day, I don't even know his name, has no idea that he was, and it was someone I almost turned away from my studio.
And I love the fact that that face is not the stereotypical image too. It is a different, it's human, more human. Yeah, really, yeah. Indeed.
Thank you.
My guest today is Rosalind Cook, a wonderful sculptor. You can see her work in over 30 life-size or larger sculptures here in Tulsa alone, another 100 around the world and around the country. She's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. She has a new book titled Capturing the Spirit in Bronze, The Journey and Sculptures of Rosalind Cook. And you can see most of those 30 sculptures that are here in Tulsa. And there's some great stories with a great many of them. I'm reminded of one of the ones that grace Utica Square. And this was a piece, I guess, Mr. Helmrich, Walt Helmrich, saw. You were doing a spec piece for the California
wine. For Napa Valley.
Yeah. So tell us that story.
Peggy and Walt came to the studio. He said, I want another piece for Utica Square. And so I said, well, come over and let's talk about it, because I'm thinking he's going to commission something of his own liking. And I was at the time working on this young woman who's harvesting grapes, and she's holding up a cluster of grapes in a whole basket, and grapes are spilling out. He said, tell me about that piece. And I said, oh, it's for the wine industry or Napa Valley. And, you know, Mr. Helmrich was a teetotaler, and he was very proud of that. And he said, oh, I don't think I like that. And I said, he said, couldn't you do it in flowers? And I said, well, it never dawned on me that I could do both, really. So I said, well, it's really just for Napa Valley. And he said, well, how much are you going to ask for that? And I told him. And he said, well, we'll talk later. And he and Peggy left. In 3 days, I had a check paid in full price. And he wrote on the bottom, no grapes, flowers only. And Peggy laughed. She said, you can tell that story. She said, Walt was used to getting what he wanted. So, you know, and I adored
him. So the grapes
him.
Became flowers.
The grapes turned into flowers. So, you know, it's wonderful people like Mr. Henry Zero and Mr. Warren. There's so many of Tulsa's great, wonderful people that I've had the privilege of working with.
I want to talk about some of the pieces that always struck me as the one that is at Southern Hills and at Mohawk. It's a golfer, a young golfer looking off in the distance. It's a beautiful, beautiful composition. Yeah. It's called Someday. How did that come about?
At that time, I wasn't a golfer. I didn't even think I'd ever care to golf. My husband loved golf. Some representatives from the PGA and Clydella and Dave Henschel, who were on the committee for the U.S. Open 2001, came to my studio and said, Rosalind, we're thinking we want to give all the players of the 2001 U.S. Open a gift. They usually get silver and crystal, and it's left in their lockers. Let's do something really special. And so would you do a sculpture of a golfer as a gift? And I said, let me think about it. I'll get back with you. So they left, and I called Hal at the office, and I said, Hal, these people want me to do a piece for the U.S. Open. I said, I had to hold the phone way away. He said, you call them right back and tell them yes. And, you know, I start doing research. Anytime I'm doing a commission, I do research. And every sculpture of a golfer I saw
catching
swinging
them in backswing.
Yeah,
uh-huh.
Exactly. Uh-huh. And I thought, I want to do something different. What is it all these guys had in common? It's not their race. It's not their education. It's not their location.
There was a kid growing up, and they wanted to play in the U.S. Open.
You got it. Yeah. You are right. They had a dream. And so it was Dave Henschel that named it Someday. So I created it. And I borrowed a little neighbor guy that was a golfer, and he came over. And we just worked on a lot of different poses because you have a lot of angles, a lot of verticals, the legs, the golf club, the bag. And so we just got into an easy position, and he's looking at leaning into his golf. You've seen this position many times.
Yeah.
Just very relaxed, looking out over the course, thinking maybe someday I could make a living at this thing I love so much, this game called golf.
It's a great piece,
yeah,
too.
Thank you.
And I bet you they didn't leave it in their lockers.
No, they didn't. Actually, they ordered some more, so some of the guys.
My guest today is sculptor Rosalind Cook. This is sort of a bittersweet moment because she has her first book, as far as I know, your first book.
It is, my first and only.
Yeah, Capturing the Spirit in Bronze, which tells the stories of her creations. But she is giving up full-time sculpting to retire. And so that's sort of bittersweet for us here in Tulsa. Yeah. But we're very happy to have her as our guest today. The book is very apparent that your spirituality is very important to you, but your sculptors also carry that spiritual moment. And it's sometimes it's overtly Christian, and other times it's more of this very sort of spiritual with a small s as far as things you're doing for the Ronald McDonald House, for Montereau, to name just a couple of places here in town. It's just an inspirational part. It seems to be a big theme in all of your work.
Mm. It is. And I don't think that it has to be liturgical to be spiritual. And I'm glad you pointed that out, because a little boy holding up a frog and discovering this great creature, that's spiritual. That's a spiritual moment as far as I'm concerned. Or children dancing and laughing, or
the readers, we have multiple generations reading together.
Legacy of literature.
Or a child reading to another child.
Relationships.
The Grace Libraries around
you.
Here. Yeah, it's the same spirituality, I think.
Thank you. You know, I get that kind of feedback, and it just thrills me because that makes it more than just a piece of bronze art, because people are inspired. And, you know, some people champion a cause with their art, and some people even want to capture horror, but that wasn't what I was called to do. I was called to celebrate life and the creator of life, and that's where I'm really happy. I'm so thrilled to have that privilege.
You mentioned the difficulty of doing the Celebrating the Arts, the minstrel that's out in front of Harweld. And was there another piece that really caused you a lot of difficulty in the execution or in the planning? I'm thinking of the piece near Woodward Park at the Herb Garden.
Oh, Linnaeus. Poems and Promises.
Yeah,
which
poems,
one?
And, poems and promises.
Actually, I created that piece when I came back from Italy, and it was a spec piece only 18 inches tall. And my challenge to myself was how can I create movement and flow and energy and unity within a piece if it's sitting still, reading? And I love to play on words, poems and promises. So it's this young girl, and she's sitting on a tree stump, and she's reading a book of poetry. And actually, there's all kinds of ways to create unity, and one is duplication of form. So if you look at her hair, and now it swirls in the back, and look at the tree trunk she's sitting on, it's a duplication of form, which creates unity within a piece. And how the shoulders are juxtaposed to the pelvis and juxtaposed to the knees. So you've got a lot of zigzag angles tied in with S-curves. The circular form of her arms holding the book are duplicated with her breasts, her buttocks, and her head. So I was thrilled with that piece. And then I actually, that was probably the one non-commissioned piece I chose to do life-size. Mm-hmm. And she's bigger than life-size, actually.
Yeah. You mentioned the Linnaeus statue. That's another challenge in of itself because, now you've done busts of folks, but that is a larger-than-life-size person of a historical personage, again, from a whole different era. You have to tell us, for those who have seen that sculpture and maybe just walk by it, there are things worth a very close examination.
Oh, yes. And that was that. In fact, when I was creating the bouquet of the flowers he's holding, which is the Oklahoma State flower, the Gallardia, I knew that children, lots of children were going to be coming, and the docents are going to be talking about Linnaeus living in the 1700s and creating the nomenclature of genus and species, which was a huge scientific contribution to our world. So I thought, I want something that the children can relate to him about. So I thought, I'm going to hide some little ladybugs in the flowers for the children to just have to look at while they're hearing all the facts for the adults. And it's really been fun to hear what the docents say. In fact, I have to tell you, the bouquet of flowers had been vandalized, had to have them cast again. And the foundry guys I only had two ladybugs. They thought it was so great. They added some of their own ladybugs. Now it's easy to find. So I thought that was funny. But when you work with foundries, you're working with artists in the foundries, and they sometimes have their own little ideas.
Well, it has been a pleasure to talk with you, and we so appreciate your contributions to our community and to the world of art. Rosalind Cook, thanks so much for joining
us. Thank you, Rich. I love being here.
Tulsa-based sculptor Rosalind Cook speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. Her new book is titled Capturing the Spirit in Bronze, The Journey and Sculptures of Rosalind Cook. She'll be signing the book this Saturday at 1 o'clock at the Tulsa Historical Society and Sunday at the Philbrook Museum of Art. For more information on signings and more information about her and the book, visit her website at rosalindcook.com. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own, do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.